Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for June 2009. This is issue number 291. If you'd like to write to us at the DX Audio Service, the address is 706 Mackenzie Drive. That's spelled M-A-C-K-E-N-Z-I-E Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Telephone number is area code 360-382-1957. Email is sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. A subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $28. To Europe and elsewhere, it's $40. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or simply log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and you can sign up using our PayPal credit card system. You can also sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service on your computer or iPod player in stereo. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to http://www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with the PayPal credit card system, or you can contact Wayne Heinen at Post Office Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047-3251, if you want to pay by check. Well, this edition of the DX Audio Service is back in the studio. Although it's a real nice day outside, it's really a hot one. So rather than sweat and read, I thought I'd come in here to the air-conditioned Sheetrock announce booth and do the DX Audio Service. Let's turn right now over to Mr. Bill Hale with a look at the AM Switch.
Thanks again, Fred, and welcome everyone to AM Switch for the DX Audio Service for June 2009. First of all, as always, we jump into call letter changes that have happened over the past month. On 610, WTFX in Winchester, Virginia has taken the call of WLVE. It's reported that this is a temporary assignment for Winchester, Virginia, so we can expect their call to change again shortly. 900, WWBK in Brunswick, Maine has changed to WCME. On 1230, WWGA in Waycross, Georgia, they changed to WAYX, but then they had a change of mind, and a week later they changed back to WWGA. So technically, you don't have to do a thing with that guy. 1240 KBGE Kilgore, Texas has changed to KDOK. 1400, a new station in Columbia Falls, Montana, they've taken the call of KQDE. On 1490, WDND South Bend, Indiana has changed to WPNT. 1550 KQNM Albuquerque, New Mexico, they've switched to KIVA. 1600 WXXY Dover, Delaware, their new call is WDPZ. And 1620 in South Bend, Indiana, the old WPNT, they changed with 1490, they're now WDND. Well, construction permits, which have taken to the air over the past month, on 770 WWCN North Fort Myers, Florida, their CP for 10,000 daytime watts, 630 watts at night, two different patterns, is now on the air. They've reduced the nighttime power along with a slight alteration of that pattern. 870 WGHC Mount Holly, North Carolina, they're now on with 5,000 watts during the day, non-directional, nothing at night. They've moved to Mount Holly from Clayton, Georgia, where they had been on 1370. 910 WSFE Burnside, Kentucky, they're now on with 430 daytime watts, 115 watts at night, all non-directional. 950 WCTN Potomac Cabin John, Maryland, they're now on with 2,500 watts during the day, 35 watts at night, two different patterns, that's U4. 970 WNYM Hackensack, New Jersey, they're now on with 50,000 watts day and night, two different patterns. 1060 WKNG Tallapoosa, Georgia, they're now on with 50,000 watts during the day, 5,000 watts critical hours, and non-directional. 1090 KEXX Excelsior Springs, Missouri, they're now on with 3,400 watts daytime only and directional. This caught me by surprise, as the only application I was aware of up until the time they changed had been for 3,000 watts. So they're now on with those extra 400 watts. 1200 WKOX Newton, Massachusetts. They're now on with 50,000 watts day and night. U4, that's two different patterns. Besides changing their city of license from Framingham, their power levels have increased and changed from a U2 operation. 1330 WRCA, Watertown, Massachusetts. They're now on with U4, 25,000 watts daytime, 17,000 watts at night, along with a city of license change from Waltham. Also on 1330 WWRV, New York, New York. They're now on with 10,000 watts daytime, 5,000 watts at night. Two different patterns from their newly constructed three-tower site. 1360 KBUY, Ruidoso, New Mexico. They're now on with 9,000 watts during the day, 201 watts at night, non-directional. 1400 WNGA, Clayton, Georgia. This new station is on the air with 1,000 watts day and night. The format is reported to be talk as they simulcast WGHC 870. 1450 KWES, Ruidoso, New Mexico. They're now on with 1,000 watts daytime, 910 watts at night. 1460 WJTI, Racine, Wisconsin. They're licensed for daytime 500 watts, 62 watts at night, all non-directional. But they've got a CP for 350 watts days, 49 watts at night, non-directional. They then requested an amendment of that construction permit for U2, 1,000 watts during the day, 240 watts at night, with a change in city of license to West Allis, which is a Milwaukee suburb, moving to the four-tower array of WGLB 1540. However, WBKV 1470 West Bend, which is also a Milwaukee suburb, objected to the close proximity of the two stations if they moved to West Allis. Now WJTI has been granted a special temporary authority of 350 watts during the day, 49 watts at night at their original location. 1470 WKCK, Orocovis, Puerto Rico. They're now on with 2,400 watts during the day, 2,500 watts at night. So they got a little boost in power at night there. That's two different patterns they use, by the way, the U4. 1480 WKGC, Southport, Florida. They're now on with 5,000 watts daytime, 34 watts at night. Along with the changes in power levels, the city of license has changed from Panama City Beach. 1540 WOGR, Charlotte, North Carolina. They're now on with a special temporary authority, 625 watts, daytime only, non-directional. And finally, 1570 WOKC, Okeechobee, Florida. They're now on with 800 watts days, 12 watts at night, non-directional, consolidating their day and night facilities at a new tower. Well, grants for new stations, we have two to report this month. On 700, a new station has been granted by the CRTC for Calgary, Alberta. When on, they'll have 50,000 watts during the day, 20,000 watts at night using two patterns. They'll be programming a Southern gospel and inspirational music format that would draw a majority of its musical selections from non-classic religious. In each broadcast week, the station will also broadcast 37 hours and 44 minutes of spoken word programming, including news, weather, sports, business reports, as well as community events. In addition, 28 hours will be devoted to religious programming each broadcast week. The station fills in the frequency vacated by the former CKRD Red Deer, which moved to FM almost a decade ago. And the other new station granted is 1340 in Jackson, California. When operational, they'll have 270 watts during the day and 1,000 watts at night, non-directional. Well, some actions over the past month. CKDH 900 in Amherst, Nova Scotia. They've been granted a move to 101.7 with 18.7 kilowatts. 920 WEZZ Brantley, Alabama. They've been granted 450 watts during the day, 450 watts during critical hours, all non-directional. Frequency has changed from 930 and a city of license from Monroeville. 930 CJYQ, St. John's, Newfoundland. They've been granted to reduce their daytime power to become U4, 25,000 watts day and night. They were 50,000 watts daytime, but they've been granted that reduction in daytime power. 960 WLPR, Pritchard, Alabama. CP has been granted for 5,000 watts during the day, 32 watts at night, all non-directional, decreasing the night power and now non-directional. 970 WJFN, Brandon, Mississippi. They've been granted 350 watts days, 90 watts at night, using a three-wire folded unipole antenna from a new location, deleting their day and night directional patterns. 1020 CKVH, High Prairie, Alberta. They've been granted a move to 93.5 megahertz with 25 kilowatts. The new station will maintain its classic hits format, with time also allotted to news, community events, weather, and what was termed surveillance, which I think is traffic, but they call it surveillance, so we'll let it go at that. A 1030 WNVR, Vernon Hills, Illinois, an STA has been granted for 5,000 watts days, 120 watts at night, 3,200 watts during critical hours, three different patterns, and we designated that as U7, and that's with limitations. Now, the application states that on April 1st, the contract engineer was doing some maintenance work at the site when a grass fire broke out. The fire destroyed all of the station's coaxial cables and sample lines, and it's expected that ordering and installing the necessary replacement parts will take a few months. So the station seeks authorization to operate with parameters at variance, but with monitor points within limits during that time. On 1050 WDVM, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, licensed for 1,000 watts days, 500 watts at night, non-directional, WDVM was granted U1, 860 days, 260 watts at night from a new replacement tower. They have now been granted an STA, a special temporary authority, of 860 watts during the day, 430 watts at night. The new tower construction has been completed and the facility is ready for WDVM to move to the new tower and resume operation. The tower owner is requiring that WDVM move onto the newer tower. The operation on the new tower remains pending, however, because the FCC staff has informed WDVM that there is a Canadian objection to grandfathered nighttime operation for WDVM that was filed way back in 1994, but remains unsolved. 1160 KCTO, Cleveland, Missouri. They've been granted 5,000 watts during the day, 230 watts at night, U4, two different patterns. 1200 WPTK, Pine Island Center, Florida. CP has been granted for 50,000 watts during the day, 1,000 watts at night, U4. 1200 WRTO, Chicago. They've been granted 20,000 watts during the day, 4,500 watts at night, U4, moving to a new six-tower site. 1230 CJNL, Merritt, Alberta. They've been granted a move to 101.1 megahertz with 200 watts. CKNL 610 will take over the 1230 transmitter in order to continue the relay of its programming in that Alberta city. 1310 CHLW, St. Paul, Alberta. They've been granted a move to 97.7 megahertz with 16 kilowatts. The new FM station will maintain its country music format with time also allotted to news, community events, weather, and surveillance. 1400 WNGA, Clayton, Georgia. They've been granted 1,000 watts day and night, all non-directional. 1400 KHCB, Galveston, Texas. They've been granted an STA for 200 watts day and night while conducting proof of performance for the new facilities, where they've just been granted 1,000 watts day and night, U4, two different patterns, kind of an oddity on a local channel, but they've got it, and moving to League City, Texas. 1470 WBKV, West Bend, Wisconsin. An STA has been granted for U4, 2,500 watts days, 1,250 watts at night. For this reason, stated in the application, WBKV discovered that new metal poles at a power utility site within the station's contour are disrupting the nighttime pattern. They're working on it with the utility company to address the issue. In the interim, WBKV respectfully requests authority to operate at 50% of authorized power for 180 days to maintain appropriate measurements at the station's monitoring points. The station plans to continue normal operations on its licensed daytime facilities. So once again, they're 2,500 watts during the day, 1,250 at night. Two patterns. Also on 1470 WNAU, New Albany, Mississippi, they've been granted U1, 2,500 watts during the day, 58 watts at night. In doing so, they'll topple two of their three towers, doing away with their directional facilities. 1480 KNIT, Dallas, Texas. They've been granted a CP to increase their daytime power to become U4, 50,000 watts days, 1,900 watts at night. They'll add three towers to their standing four to accommodate the extra daytime power. The new day pattern will be largely directed to the northwest with a smaller lobe to the southeast. And finally, 1540 WOGR, Charlotte, North Carolina. They've been granted an STA for D1, 625 watts, daytime only, non-directional. Applications this past month, 570 CFWH, Whitehorse, Yukon Territory. They've applied to move to 94.5 with 3.3 kilowatts at 420.5 meters. The applicant intends to operate the existing facilities as they do now of relays of that Whitehorse station in Watson Lake, Mayo, Elsa, Teslin, Beaver Creek, Swift River, Carmax, Ross River, Atlin, Faro, Destruction Bay, Haines Junction, and Dawson City. 1190 KREB, Bentonville, Bella, Arkansas. They've applied for 5,000 watts days, 14 watts at night, non-directional. If granted, they would add the nighttime service while dropping the currently authorized critical hours operation. 1260 KBSF Spring Hill, Louisiana. They've applied for 5,000 watts during the day, 220 watts at night, all non-directional, moving to a new tower and changing the city of license across the state line to Nash, Texas. 1530 WENG Englewood, Florida. They've applied for 1,000 watts days, 1 watt at night, non-directional, adding that nighttime watt. Applications for new stations on 780 Mulberry, Florida has applied for 250 watts day and night, two different patterns, that'll be U4. Some applications which were dismissed, 940 KTON Belton, Texas, they applied for directional 50,000 watts daytime only, relocating to Lancaster, which is a suburb south of Dallas, so that's out. 960, a new station in Markham, Ontario, they applied for a kilowatt days, 175 watts at night, that's off the books. 1350, a new station in Scarborough, Ontario, was turned down, they applied for a kilowatt days and 87 watts at night, non-directional. 1460, WBUC, Buckhannon, West Virginia, they applied for 5,500 watts during the day, 24 watts at night, non-directional. And WONX, 1600, Chicago Heights, Illinois, application to move to Jenison, Michigan on 1020 has been denied. We'll have another word about WONX in just a minute. Remember last month we reported that WCGO 1590 in Evanston, Illinois had signed on with their new facilities of 7,000 watts during the day, 2,500 watts at night, U2. Well, now the FCC has officially deleted three other Chicago area stations which were owned by the same company that owns WCGO, which were taken off specifically to accommodate the increase of daytime power for WCGO. Remember, this station is WONX, and back before 1979, they went by WLTD. Those deleted stations are WKKD 1580 Aurora, 1590 WCGO, which they changed the call letters in Chicago Heights, and 1600 WMCW in Harvard. We reported that in a previous edition. So they knocked off three stations in order to boost up the power for one. AM on FM relays, simulcasts, whatever you want to call them. First of all, 1000 KOMO Seattle, Washington is being simulcast on KOMO 97.7 in Oakville, Washington. 1210 WILY Centralia, Illinois is heard on W254BE 98.7 Centralia. 1430 KBRC Mount Vernon, Washington. They're relayed on K271AH 102.1 in Kamano. And 1550 WLOR Huntsville, Alabama. They're being heard on W251AC 98.1 MHz in Capshaw, Alabama. IDs heard include Sunny 98 and AM 1550 with their two oldies format 24/7. Well, wrapping things up, reported off, WARM Scranton, PA was off, but then back on with oldies with reduced power. WOHS 730, Shelby, North Carolina. KHWG 750, Fallon, Nevada, because they had a fire in the transmitter building. KTNS 1060, Oakhurst, California was off due to financial reasons. KNEK 1190, Washington, Louisiana due to transmitter failure. WLNR 1230, Kinston, North Carolina. KBSZ 1250, Wickenburg, Arizona. KXAM 1310, Mesa, Arizona. WLLN 1370, Lillington, North Carolina. KYLS, Fredericktown, Missouri on 1450 is off. WECM 1490, Milton, Florida. WDND, South Bend, Indiana is off. They're also on 1490. KXLQ 1490, Indianola, Iowa, and KRSN 1490, Los Alamos, New Mexico. Those last four there making that clear, or that local channel just a little clearer. Returning to the airwaves, WFEB 1340, Sylacauga, Alabama. They're back with Talk Sports. WTKI 1450, Huntsville, Alabama, and WDPD 1490, Decatur, Alabama were on temporarily, probably to beat the 12-month off or lose your license rule, but soon afterwards they're back to silence. Also back on, WHSC 1450, Hartsville, South Carolina. They're back with ESPN Sports. WTRI 1520 Brunswick, Maryland with Classic Country and ID heard as Radio Earl. And finally, WLUZ 1600, Bayamon, Puerto Rico. Some fines, $7,000 to WHMA 1390, Anniston, Alabama, and $4,800 forfeiture to WSSC 1340, Sumter, South Carolina. Well, my thanks go out to Sean Axelrod, Bill Dvorak, Tony Fitzherbert, Wayne Heinen, Dean McIntyre, Dave Schmidt, Ed Soule, and you, the supporters of the NRC and the DX Audio Service. And now here's John Bowker taking us on another walk down memory lane. John?
Well, thanks very much, Bill Hale, and hello, everybody. Welcome to the Travelogue. Now, most of you will understand that what we've been doing for the past few months, and what I fully expect we'll do for a few more months, is to listen to some station IDs that we recorded over the last 30 or 40 years. And at least it'll be good to hear this one more time. The very first station today, for instance, no longer exists in Seattle, Washington. At one time, it was called KOL 1300. It was full power, 5,000 watts day and night. You can't beat that. For 1300, you can't anyway. At least in the good old days, you couldn't beat 5,000 watts at 1300. There are no holds barred anymore, as you know. KOL was one of the top 40 stations on the West Coast, and so many things have changed in the Seattle radio market these days. Well, I could keep you a little bit up to date. This station now has changed its call letters to KKOL after going through a couple of other breaks in between. It's now 50,000 watts at 1300. Holy mackerel. It was at one time the only floating transmitter station in the United States for a broadcaster. And I think right now it's being studied because it may be causing dangerous power levels to the place on the docks in Seattle where they're unloading petroleum products. But none of those things are the reason that I made these recordings and kept them for you. Let's listen to KOL's station break and particularly to its slogan. In 1967, as we begin the June 2009 DX Audio Service Travelogue.
You're listening to the Rex Hamilton Walker the First Show from Seattle's Much More Music Station, AM and FM.
Colorful KOL Seattle.
Great Pacific Northwest.
Yes, there it was. What was that slogan one more time?
Seattle's Much More Music Station.
KOL Seattle.
Well, now, I find that particularly interesting because on the same day, if you swing down to 1090 on the dial, this is what you hear.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Much More Music with Mike Brody.
K-I-N-G, Seattle.
49 minutes of dynamite music.
Well, let's see if I have this straight. They're both playing Much More Music, and it makes you wonder, what does more mean? I guess you have to have it defined. Say, this next station also comes from Seattle, but I'm off on a different subject now. This is KJR coming up. Remember, 950 on the dial? Sure. Their singing jingle is different from, I think, others I know, in the discordance of the last notes, the two phrases they have in this jingle. You listen to them carefully. Quite discordant and very, very nice. And boy, you could be very sure that the next sound, the next bit of audio would be music. But I'm wondering if they had to be very careful, the key of the next song, to be sure that it fit in well with what you just heard. I think that's excellent. I love that sort of thing. Now, this next ID, okay, nothing special, but I play it for old time's sake. I enjoyed seeing this station's billboard right in downtown Cleveland as we would drive through on the interstate. It was right next to where the new baseball field is now. And it was up for years and years, and it was sort of a landmark on our trip from New Jersey to Chicago all the time. And then one day it came down. And Cleveland's tribute at 1220 on the AM dial to its very own President Garfield was lost forever.
A service of Nationwide Communications.
WTAR-FM and AM, Cleveland.
Well, okay. At least I enjoyed hearing it again. Say, right across town from there was the original station in Cleveland. Can you tell me what that was? Quick. 1420 on the dial. Yeah, WHK. In fact, somewhere, years ago, I remember hearing that WHK's license was the first one issued by Herbert Hoover, who had just become the secretary of whatever it would be that then signed radio licenses. So that would have made it 1922, and that means that WHK probably had come on the air as an experimental station with an amateur type of call sign.
The greatest oldies all the time.
WHK, Cleveland.
Now this next one is from New York City. It's just a little bit different, but it was used for many years by the good guys station, WMCA at 570.
This is 570, WMCA, New York.
WMCA, New York, New York.
Well, okay. Now, I don't know how many of you go back into the 1960s, but there were two stations in Philadelphia that were really slugging it out with each other. One was WIBG at 99, and the other was WFIL at 560. Now, of the two, the reception of the two stations was about the same, over certainly over the Philadelphia market. But each of them had an LP record, and they put out one a year for several years, each claiming to be the music station in Philadelphia. Now, WIBG's ID was a group of people all saying the call letters simultaneously. And, you know, you hear one of those, you heard them all. Here's how WFIL sounded.
WFIL, Philadelphia.
And any of you who were with us at the Culpsville, Pennsylvania convention, what, 3-4 years ago? You'll remember that we went to the WFIL transmitting facilities, and we were royally treated. As a matter of fact, the chief engineer of WFIL is a member of the National Radio Club. Well, okay, we're going back to the Midwest now, and there are two stations. I probably recorded them on the same trip, going from east to west at some time, but they have always confused me as to which station was which. Now, one of them's in Toledo, and the other one's in South Bend, and I always felt they got the call letters backwards between those two cities.
The Browns!
Now, I must admit that I probably confused myself more than anything else. I was hearing that as WSPT Toledo, and the T, of course, is for Toledo, and who knows what the SP was for. But it isn't. That last letter is a D, as in the name David. And if we now go from 1370 down to 960 on the dial, we pick up the other station that confused me. This is in South Bend, WSBT.
News is next.
WSBT.
Well, now, I have to ask you, how many someplace specials are there in the United States?
This is your news, sports and entertainment leader for North Central Ohio, Someplace Special, WLEC, Sandusky.
Now, I'll tell you something about Sandusky, Ohio you may not have ever heard before, and that is, up until Walt Disney started building Disneyland and Disney World, Sandusky was one of the most visited communities in the United States. And do you know why? Yeah, good, that's right. Cedar Point and the huge entertainment and recreational complex there. They tell me it's still the third most visited place in the United States, besides Anaheim and Orlando. And on that note, I hope you're making plans or have already made your plans to attend the National Radio Club convention in over Labor Day. Well, I must admit to you that for over 38 years, I lived within 60 miles of these next two stations. And the two recordings you're going to hear are the only two I picked up from them. So maybe you can do better over Labor Day. If you go to the convention and make a recording of either or both of these stations, your collection of IDs will be better than mine.
It's 8 o'clock. We're more than just a music station. Radio 1230, WEEX Easton.
Good evening. In the WEEX News Center, I'm Suzanne LaFranchi.
So Phil hits two, and the Rovers lead by four at 14-10. 3:45 to go in the first quarter. Here on WEST, AM 14 in Easton, Pennsylvania.
Well, now for this next station, one of life's little moments. I was in the city of Valparaiso in Indiana, where our oldest son had just enrolled in college. This takes us back 30 years, just to keep you calibrated. And I was walking around the town and stumbled onto WNWI in Valparaiso, 1080 on the dial, and met a young newscaster there. He seemed very spirited and had had some high school experience broadcasting, I think in Indianapolis. We chatted for a few minutes. It turns out he was just entering Valparaiso University, the same as our son was doing. About 2 days later, I went to visit our son in his new dormitory room. Yes, guess who his roommate was? John Bartholomew, who wound up on WIBC later on.
That's going to be our overnight low, yesterday's high 22. For WNWI News, I'm John Bartholomew.
Northwest Indiana's music is something special. WNWI.
Now, those of you who know me well know that for many years I've been saying that AM radio is a phenomenon of the 20th century. Okay, here we are well into the 21st century, but not that far yet. And this last ID we'll play for you this month, it kind of shows what I'm talking about.
KBIX Highland Park. And on KBIL-FM, Highland Park, Dallas, Fort Worth.
Sounds to me like the announcer never heard of KVIX on the AM side. Now, I see we're running out of time, so I got to make this kind of quick. But, you know, for years and years, I listened to Cameron Swayze on NBC News, and then he moved to WCBS in New York, I know. But I didn't know until his father died in 1995 that Cameron Swayze was the son of John Cameron Swayze, the first NBC television news anchor, the NBC Camel Caravan.
WWRC
Washington.
NBC News. Good morning. This is Cameron Swayze reporting.
And then to further complicate my life, the brief time I spent at KNBR in San Francisco, the 680, my boss's name was John Cameron, and he claimed no relationship at all to the Swayzes. That does it for us this month. We'll be back in 30. Here's Mark Durenberger.
Well, thanks, John, and welcome all to our continuing series of reports on the development of the AM broadcast band. Last month, we concluded with a group of intended channel changes, and we read to you from a list complete as of November 30th, 1930. We also mentioned that we wouldn't spend a lot of time in the 30s because many of the heritage stations were well in place and settled down, so to speak. The 1930s would be known as the radio decade. More than any other period, the events of the 30s would have a profound impact on the development of radio as a world power. Much of the world would endure a Great Depression. Europe would be overrun by a madman dictator, and another war would erupt, as radio's news gathering matured just in time to cover the greatest story of the century. Radio was right for its time. The mad radio scrambles of the 1920s experimental radio world would morph into a mature broadcasting industry led by the networks who developed the entertainment programming to help keep Americans' minds off their troubles a half hour at a time. You hear the stories of families gathered around the radio in the living room. That radio was the most important piece of furniture in the house and the center of family living. In the early 30s, battery sets were still used on those farms without electricity. Auto sets became popular around 1930. They were cumbersome devices with a tuning head under the dash, linked by mechanical cables to a big box with a buzzer vibrator in the trunk. So while the receiver universe was developing, on the broadcasting side, there was more stability. There were some 600 stations on the air licensed as of March 1931, though not all were completely built. There were 7 stations in Alabama, 3 in Alaska, 7 in Arizona, 8 in Arkansas, 45 in California, 13 in Colorado, 3 in Connecticut, 2 in Delaware, 3 in the District of Columbia. There were 10 in Florida and Georgia, 2 in Hawaii, 6 in Idaho, 37 in Illinois, 16 in Indiana, 19 in Iowa. There were 8 in Kansas, 5 in Kentucky, 12 stations in Louisiana, 4 in Maine and Maryland. There were 15 in Massachusetts, actually 14, since WBZ had 2 counted as 1 with their synchronous operation. Michigan had 17, Minnesota 10, Mississippi 7, Missouri 19, Montana 5. There were 11 stations in Nebraska, just 2 in Nevada and 1 in New Hampshire. 14 in New Jersey, 3 in New Mexico. New York had 53 across the state, 7 in North Carolina, 6 in North Dakota. Ohio had 21, Oklahoma had 12 stations, Oregon 13, Pennsylvania 38, 5 in Rhode Island, 3 in South Carolina, 9 in South Dakota, 15 in Tennessee, and 34 in Texas. Utah had 3 stations, Vermont 4, Virginia 12, Washington State 23, West Virginia 5, Wisconsin 17, and there was 1 radio station in Wyoming. Again, totaled about 610 AM stations. Some would fall by the wayside, others would rush in to take their places. Most of the Class A stations on the high end of the dial were still operating at 50 to 100 watts, although some were allowed 250 to 500. Interestingly, in the early 30s, all stations still operated with the flat tops. Then, late in 1932, WFLA WSUN in Tampa built the first two-tower directional and shared 620 kilocycles with WTMJ in Milwaukee, which also directionalized, and they protected each other. And a new engineering branch of AM radio broadcasting was born, the directional antenna. They were cooking along with a few hundred watts on those stations, but up the road, the big guys were expanding. The radio dial chart for 1927 shows WGY, reportedly the first to do so, using 50,000 watts on a special temporary basis, daytime. They were fully licensed for unlimited time, 50,000 watts, in January 1928. Close on their heels was WEAF in New York City. And Radio World for December 13, 1930, reported that 29 other stations were applying for 50 kilowatts. They were WAPI, WBAL, WBBM, WBT, WBZ, WCAU, WCCO, WCFL, WFBM, WGN, WLIB, WHAM, WHAS, WHO/WOC, WJR, WJZ, WMAQ, WMC, WOR, WOWO, WREC, WGAN, WSB, WSM, WTMJ, WWJ, KJO, KOA, KPO, KSL, and KVOO. The rest of the 50 kilowatt upgrade story will await our second installment, we'll call State of the Station, in which we'll chronicle some of the big heritage operations on a station-by-station basis to see how they developed. We mentioned that the sheriffs of the airwaves were being somewhat subordinated to the industry that they were to police, but this was really only true when it came to policy and regulation. The enforcement side was another matter entirely. And starting early in the 1930s and until the current era of deregulation, the very thought of an FCC radio inspector at your door could cause otherwise hale-hearty and confident men to quake in their boots. The June 1931 issue of Radio News tells the story of Uncle Sam's new $250,000 radio receiver at Grand Island, Nebraska, established to determine that stations were staying on frequency and that they weren't over-modulating or doing other nasty things. The beverage antennas at Grand Island were described in our interview with John McKinney, and they were formidable, able to hear just about every radio station in the country. What a great place it would have been for a QSLer to spend a weekend. With the feds monitoring stations, broadcasting too loud was a good way to get sighted. Early in the 30s, experimenters were proposing use of the long waves, 200 to 500 kilocycles, for domestic broadcasting. Stations were coming on the air on long wave in Europe and elsewhere, and developers felt that such channels could provide solid, fade-free reception across vast distances. But that model worked best when the country of interest, Poland comes to mind for their successful early operation, is somewhat limited in geographical size. Long-wave broadcasting to the contiguous 48 American states would have required either prodigious amounts of energy or long-wave repeaters, and the number of stations would be limited, so it would be very hard to build a receiver audience. Superpower long-wave had serious toy value, but the domestic band of choice was what was now called the standard broadcast band, 550 to 1500. Another idea they had was to send a coordinated broadcast signal cross-country to tie a number of stations together on the same frequency with the same programming. This was similar to the synchronous transmitter operations like WBZ were using, but it was meant to be a national connection of, for example, all stations on 1330. All would be fed the same program. Their transmitters would be synchronized by the national signal so they didn't interfere with each other. Well, that one, too, was another idea of appeal to technoids, but impractical to realize before the era of satellites and GPS. Oh, yes. Also at this time, a fellow named Major Armstrong was playing with something called frequency modulation, or FM, early in the 30s. But his time had not yet come. AM was still king. And by 1935, there were still about 600 stations broadcasting on the standard band, a good number of them now at 50 kilowatts. The band still 550 to 1500, but in April 1934, the Federal Radio Commission held hearings on establishing three channels above the upper end of the band for high-fidelity operation. It was one of the FRC's last activities. The Federal Communications Commission would be established a couple of months later in June 1934. The high-fidelity channels that were opened were 1530, 1550, and 1570. There would be nobody on 1520, 1540, 1560, and 1580. Operators were given double the bandwidth so they could transmit full-frequency sound. Applications were few. There were only six to make it to the hearings. The FRC approved four of them. They were W1XBS, Waterbury, Connecticut, W9XBY in Kansas City, W6XAI, Bakersfield, California, and W2XR, Long Island City, New York. But it never caught on. Receiver manufacturers couldn't see a return on investment in building a super wideband radio, and the audience was limited to hobbyists who could get their hands on the few radios available. The NARBA agreement, published in 1941, would remove the protection around these three frequencies, opening up the whole band 1510 to 1600 permanently, and it would move these four operators. While the country grooved on the standard broadcast band, the new events of the 30s created a demand for knowledge of current events, both in this country and abroad. Radio was just starting to develop serious news operations. Listeners were finding shortwave radio to be the best source for international news as it happened, even though a lot of it was filtered through the home country's propaganda machine. There are varied historical accounts about the beginnings of international broadcasting. Germany may have been the first country to use it as early as 1915. It established a regular radio news service that was accepted and used by multiple neutral countries in the region. Russia's initial use of international radio broadcasting dates back to 1917 and its effort to explain the facts behind the revolution to the rest of the world. However, on both accounts, the German and the Russian early efforts, these early broadcasts were Morse code, heard by a relatively few listeners. In England, a major BBC goal was preserving contact with the colonies. Foreign language programming did not commence until 1938, long after the Axis stations had begun their own foreign language services. Indeed, the success of German shortwave was a factor in the British commitment to a shortwave service of its own. The Vatican City Radio had come on the air in 1931, and the first missionary station was the world-famous HCJB, lighting up on Christmas Day in 1931 and still operating as a world power. In the early 1930s, the Netherlands began regular transmission in Dutch to the East Indies, while France started French broadcasts to its colonies. When Adolf Hitler became chancellor of the National Socialist Government in Germany, he embraced the use of broadcasting as the chief instrument of political propaganda, and he reorganized its primarily domestic broadcasting arrangements to include overseas transmissions. By the end of 1935, Germany had successfully transmitted regular programs to Asia, Africa, South America, and North America in German, English, Spanish, Portuguese, and Dutch, all shortwave. The Nazis actually subsidized receiver manufacturing so every German could have a radio. That would enable the Nazis to reach everyone with their propaganda, not only in relatively factual terms, as did newspapers, but also by using radio's strong emotional power. During the Spanish Civil War, the nationalist forces in Spain received a powerful transmitter as a gift of Nazi Germany to aid their propaganda efforts. And until 1943, Radio Nacional de España collaborated with the Axis powers to retransmit in Spanish the news from the official radio stations of Germany and Italy, and Americans were tuned in. Italian shortwave began in Rome, usually rebroadcasting the daily programs of Italian domestic stations, but also presenting special programs for the Americas. The American Hour was broadcast on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. They utilized an interesting form of propaganda, Italian language lessons based on Il Duce's own speeches. You sent your language homework to Rome for correction, and you received fascist propaganda by return mail. Except in the Americas, broadcasting, including shortwave, was a government monopoly, usually supported by an annual fee on receiving sets. Before World War II, U.S. shortwave was solely in private hands. The giants of the U.S. radio industry, Westinghouse, NBC, General Electric, CBS, and Crosley, most of them operated shortwave facilities co-located with their high-power AM transmitters so that they could share engineering and electrical resources. For a time, most of these shortwave stations simply simulcast the programming on their standard broadcast outlets. Some of these shortwave broadcasters were in the radio manufacturing business, hopeful that this broadcasting in shortwave would help create markets for their new shortwave radios. Some smaller stations went on shortwave just to satisfy an engineer's desire to dabble in a new medium, while others wanted to provide programming for rebroadcast via local broadcast band relay stations in other countries. And this last point is important. Although today we think of shortwave in terms of direct broadcasting, in the early days the usual goal was to use shortwave to get the signal to the target area for pickup and then rebroadcast by local medium wave stations. This is why in this country, before the advent of the AT&T connected wire networks, the government had licensed experimental relay rebroadcasting, transmission of broadcast material from one station to another, for rebroadcast to the public by the ground relay station on its regular broadcast frequency. Well, meanwhile at home, by the end of the 1930s, radio stations reached the peak of their technical development. Several FM stations began broadcasting. Live TV broadcasts began from the 1939 New York World's Fair, and the Federal Communications Commission was preparing to change the frequency assignment of almost every standard band radio station in the United States. And that story, the details of the 1941 North American Regional Broadcasting Agreement, or NARBA, is a tale to be told when next we meet. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. See you in 30 days. And until then, good listening, DXers.
Thanks, Mark. And before we flip over to Side 2, I just want to remind everyone that we are giving away DX dollars to people who help us out at the DX Audio Service. And in fact, we've issued a couple DX dollars out just this past month. Also, on a sad note, I wish to report that Mike Lance's guide dog, Lexi, suddenly passed away just before press time. So please keep Mike Lance in your thoughts and prayers. At this time, let's push the button and go to Night Pattern, or flip over to Side 2 of the DX Audio Service.
Let us take it easy together.
WXYZ.